we started doing some kind of not marketing, but a little bit of evangelization, building the community. So it was a little bit more external facing and not just, you know, us in front of a computer writing code. Because in some way, the process of writing code is kind of very liberating, you know, like you do your thing, you know, you get good work. It doesn't really matter if someone uses your product or not. When you start having users, it's a different story.
If you have a business, you need a website. What's the best way to get a website up and running? By choosing a company that makes it simple, like Pear Networks. Pear has over 20 years of experiences managing the entire digital ecosystem for thousands of online businesses all around the world. Pear makes it really easy for you with do-it-yourself website building tools and features, including simple drag-and-drop page design. And they have guaranteed US-based support technicians ready to help you whenever you need it, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Right now, when you sign up with Pear Networks, you will receive 1 free month of web hosting. See for yourself how easy it is to build your website for free. That's pear.com/grace to get started today. Hi, Emmanuel. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
So to start the show, I saw that you were originally from France and your first job was like teaching, and then you were a researcher, and then you were a consultant. Before we jump into like all the business question, I would love to learn a little bit more on like, you know, how you grew up and how you got to where you are now.
Sure. So yeah, as you said, I am originally from France. I left France about 15 years ago, which means that I did all my childhood and college education in France. Grew up pretty simply in the countryside in Normandy, northwest of France. I started being exposed to computers on the pretty early side. I think I was like 12 when I started programming, just because I didn't have too much to do in the countryside, you know, especially when it's raining and in the fall or the winter. The other thing I spent quite some time doing was learning Mandarin, actually, because my parents had met in Beijing in 1978, so quite early on. And so that's actually important because fast forward, you know, 6 years later, after I left home and after I graduated high school, when it was about looking for my first job, yes, I did spend a year as a full-time teacher, but it was part of my curriculum. It was kind of the military service that I was expected to do because of the school I went to. But what I would consider my first like full-time job was consulting in China. So I spent a few years there. That experience that took me to the US in many ways, because when I was in France, I never thought I would go to business school. The French educational system is very hard, intense, hardcore on hard sciences, you know, mathematics in particular. And we don't necessarily look at MBA and business education as, you know, something that is not fluffy. But my time in China, I guess, convinced me that there was something to discover there and that the US was a country I wanted to explore because I had been not really exposed to the United States at that point. And so I applied to business school and got into Harvard. And here I am, you know, 11 years later, I'm in the US.
Yeah. So I was wondering, when you were younger, like, what did you want to do? And then what kind of skill do you consider as your like unfair advantage?
Great question. I never thought really I would be an entrepreneur. I was programming quite a bit as a kid. I made a little bit of money actually selling, you know, on like floppy disks, some little things I was building in Delphi and Quick Basic to my classmates, but it was more for fun than anything. I would say I was very French and I wanted to work for the French government when I was a kid and even when I was in college. The reason being, and I still think it's the case actually, like if you're looking to have some impact, and a lot of people, especially when they're good at school, want to have impact, they want to feel like they work on big problems of the world. Turns out, I think the French government is a great place to do that still today in France, just because of the way the system works. And it's very different in the United States, for instance. Like in the United States, you probably have more impact in the private sector. And so that's what I wanted to do. And the full story actually with my work in China, that initially I was expected to go back because I already had secured a job with the government and it just didn't go back. Now, for my unfair advantage, I think I've been fortunate enough to be exposed to a lot of different things pretty young. And the school system in France trains you to be good at a lot of different things. And so one thing I'm very good at is context switching and getting into stuff that on paper don't have too much to do with each other. So when we started Bubble, so initially, I guess we'll get into that a little bit later, but I joined my co-founder, actually, Josh. Mm-hmm. Like, he had started, and I was not technical at that point. Like, I have forgotten how I hadn't written code for more than 10 years at that point. And pretty quickly, I got back into it. And now I consider myself an engineer. Like, I wrote a lot of code, even though I don't do that anymore today. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I very much think goes back to my educational background, to be able to be, you know, either on the business side or the technical side. For the last thing that I had that I developed in China, actually. So my Mandarin was fairly good, but I certainly wouldn't say it was like bilingual or native. And I was doing most of my consulting projects in Mandarin. And so I had to learn pretty early on to be able to work in a pretty high pressure environment, because consulting tends to be high pressure, not necessarily understanding everything that I was doing, that was going on around me, because most of the business presentations, the documents I had to read were all in Mandarin. And so being able to go through that consulting life without feeling 100% sure that I knew exactly what I had to do, for instance, but still figuring out on the way and not freaking out over it, was something that has become like a special skill that I have that I don't think a ton of people have, honestly.
For sure. I feel like jumping into the Chinese business scene in general, like, because I feel like I could imagine it could be a culture shock for a lot of people. As someone from China, when I came to the US, I feel like it's a completely different situation. And I heard a lot of my American friends, whoever worked in China, they all definitely feeling this is like a gigantic change compared to the European American culture. I think like your last job before you started Bubble or joined your co-founder to work at Bubble was you were working as an assistant for the CEO of Prada. What was that experience like?
It was a summer job. You know, it was my summer job during business school. So I was like kind of a chief of staff or like special assistant. I mean, you have different ways to call that, to the CEO of Prada USA. It was very fun. But it was 10 weeks.
What were you doing there?
So these kind of roles are like, I mean, basically what your chief of staff does usually, which means ask the boss, so the CEO in that case, what is important to look at, and he doesn't have the time to do a deep dive, and you do deep dives for him. So I looked at modeling a little bit better their financials, between their words, thinking about, and that has nothing to do with technology, but concession versus full retail and wholesale. You know, it's three different ways to sell products in the United States, and they have different constraints and everything. So trying to figure out, you know, how to migrate from one setup to another setup that they had. So it was pretty quantitative. Actually, not some programming, but a little bit of analytical work in Microsoft Access back then, which is actually a great product, to automate some of the processes they had, which had a pretty big impact on how the team was functioning. I mean, Prada USA, if you don't include people from the stores, it's only like, you know, 100 people at most. It's not that big. And then I started looking at the after sales service, which is, you know, how can you improve the processes around fixing handbags? So I would say nothing too glamorous. And one of the things I learned in that industry only for 3 months is the power of these brands. You know, like companies like Prada or Louis Vuitton are able to basically pay pretty much everything, advertising, people, less, because people are fascinated by the brand. And that's really the value of the brand. Mm-hmm. And so from the outside, it looks extremely glamorous. But from the inside, there is indeed like a PR creative side that is very glamorous. But the retail side, you know, it's retail, which is a great business, but it's a pretty old school business, you know, like not too much innovation, especially if it's luxury goods, because you have to be very careful to the brand. And yeah, then it's about, you know, building after sales service to fix the handbags when, you know, something is broken.
So what is like the KPI like for like a fashion company like Prada? Because as an outsider, so you constantly see like Prada doing extremely exciting partnerships with younger generation, Gen Z TikTok singers or something. But I guess like what is the KPI drive by? Is that like, oh, how can we preserve the brand as like it looks prestigious throughout the years? Or do you feel like it's more about like how much sales can we make over the years?
So first of all, from what I could see, it's a very tough one. Second of all, I've only went there for 3 months, so it's pretty short.
Right.
What I felt what was going on more in an entity like Prada USA, which again is not Prada globally, which is going to be in SPA, which is in Italy, is sales. I think at some point, you know, the company, I was there at a pretty exciting time because it's when the company went public. So I was part of a company going public in Hong Kong. And so at that point, what people care about, especially financial analysts, are going to be sales. There is indeed a question, you know, a very strategic question, which is how much do you want to flood the market and make sales in the short term versus the long term? Without getting into that too much, I think that's what differentiates, for instance, Louis Vuitton from Hermès. You know, Hermès is trying to be more high-end and sell less because it's better for the long term. I think this decision is at the very, very top of the company deciding these things. It's not something that necessarily, I mean, then it impacts the goal, but then for the different entities on the ground, then the goal remains sales.
Yeah, for sure. So throughout the journey, who do you consider as on your personal board of advisors from, you know, teaching to like doing, becoming a researcher, consultant, and then now you're like a very successful founder. Who do you bounce off your career decisions with?
I used to have a couple of people I would call out. I mean, business school was a good place for that because you get exposed to a lot of people. At the end of the day, though, I think the biggest decisions need to be made alone, especially career decisions.
Curious, like, what do you consider as one skill that you're constantly trying to get better at?
I think managing people, be able to lead a team, set goals, get the team to deliver outcome that they didn't think was possible in the first place is the kind of the secret, that secret sauce, you know, building a successful company. And it's something that I think I still need to improve. We have a little bit of a non-traditional history because we didn't raise money for a very long time, like 7 years. And so we only started hiring people 5 years in. And so of all the muscles I had to flex, you know, during this journey, managing people is something that I started flexing pretty late, you know, like after 2017. So today we have 60 people. So it starts becoming like a pretty decent sized organization. But I certainly have written more code than I have managed people over the last 9 years. And so now I have to catch up on that.
So you guys started Bubble in 2012. Over the years, I assume like Bubble went through multiple different phases. What are some stages that you guys went through? And from each stage, what were your day-to-day like at that point?
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess for me personally, not for the company, the first stage was to learn how to code again, because pretty quickly I started realizing, okay, if I don't write code, there's not too much to do here. So I had to do that. It took me 3 to 5 months or something like that. I mean, I started writing code earlier, but that was not necessarily like very effective. Then it was a lot of product development for the first, you know, 2-3 years where we basically, so we started from a user problem. We didn't start with a technical vision. I mean, there was a technical vision, but fundamentally the problem we were trying to fix was for people. And these people were non-technical founders in need of a product for their company, the company they wanted to get off the ground. And so the first 2-3 years were basically us building the product, recruiting some users. I'm saying recruiting because it really took some interviewing on both sides. You know, like we needed to make sure what they wanted to build was doable on Bubble. We wanted to make sure they were committed. Obviously, we had to convince them that we were committed because we were asking them to do something pretty big on the platform, you know, bet their whole business on Bubble. And so doing all of that was a lot of manual, like human interactions. It's not like someone would come on our website and sign up at that point. You could, but not many people would do that seriously. And so the first 2 years were like, then the day-to-day is, well, two co-founders writing code, both having different projects, handling user requests, and you're not short of that. Because when you tell users, people, when you don't need to be a software engineer to build your product, use our product and do it. In the first years, today it's different, but in the first years, they hit a lot of issues and a lot of blocking, like dead ends and stuff like this. And so you need to keep improving the product. So that basically means, you know, getting emails or some type, hop on a Skype call with a user, because back then it was Skype, understand what they want to do and figure out what the right way to do this with your product that is still in line with the product philosophies that you have, but expand the product capabilities so that they could do their thing. Because our commitment to them was, you know, we'll do what we can to make it work so that you can build anything you want. And like 9 years later, it's the reason why our product in the now pretty busy no-code space is fairly clearly identified by everyone as the most powerful one, because the depth of features we have just doesn't have any comparison in the market. There is a flip side to that, which means you need to learn the product more, like because the more open-ended a product is, the more learning it takes usually. But today, we're the only platform where you can build Twitter without code, for instance. It's not something that other tools can do. So the first few years are just about building features and features and features. Then between year 3 and 4 or 5, this was kind of the tougher part because we started having enough users that we started getting pressure from existing users whose businesses started scaling on the platform. We started doing some kind of, not marketing, but a little bit of evangelization, building the community. So it was a little bit more external facing and not just, you know, us in front of a computer writing code. Because in some way, the process of writing code is kind of very liberating. You know, like you do your thing, you know, you're getting good work. Doesn't really matter if someone uses your product or not. when you start having users, it's a different story. And so that took us for maybe another like 2 years. And then we started hiring people. And that phase, well, the first 10 hires we made were out of our bootstrapping revenue. So we were like getting revenue from paying people with our revenue. And then we raised our first round in 2019. Things started accelerating a little bit because we had more financial means. So then, you know, the team went from like 12 to I think about 20 at the beginning of the pandemic. And then the pandemic happened, which like for everyone in the world was a big change. And for us as well, you know, we had to move full remote. We started having much faster growth because pretty much, you know, everything online was going well. And Bubble in particular was pretty well suited to grow fast during the pandemic. And leading us to now 60 people, the round we just closed a few months ago, and being pretty busy with things today.
Yeah, for sure. So the first phase was like you were essentially like the product phase. Like you and your co-founder would go to like these like co-founder meetups, basically recruiting people to join you guys. And then it would become like, you know, user evangelizing phase. And then you guys becoming like basically the recruiting phase or slash like fundraising phase. So like basically covers like the whole like startup cycle. When it comes to like evangelizing phase, like, so at that point, you guys already have like the basic product down. At what point, like, did you kind of started to recruiting more user?
Late 2015, when we started, we went on Product Hunt and we got like a very, very good reaction there. Like we had, I think, one of the better Product Hunt launches out there. It's also because we had waited 3 years. So at some point, you know, if you wait long enough, then you have a better product and it works better. And through that, it started being the community. Like community has been our main growth driver at the beginning and still today. Word of mouth, people telling their friends about us. It's something that people often forget because no code today is hard, that it's still a space where skepticism is very high because people think that it's not possible to build real things without code, right? And so when I go to a podcast and I tell people, no, you can build something like Twitter without code, I hope I'm, you know, convincing and genuine enough that people trust me, but I don't think 100% of people will trust what I'm saying because at the end of the day, I'm selling my business here, right? If your friend tells you, no, I learned it and it works and I was able to build this and I'm not technical, I mean, it's 100% conversion rate on that front. Like, you're not going to start telling your friend that your friend is lying, right? Otherwise, it's not your friend. And so that's how we grew a lot. And that's the kind of thing that happened offline. So the kind of interactions I just described. But a lot of it can also happen online because that's, you know, people blogging, social media. Like when people not affiliated with Bubble start saying that Bubble works, this is an extremely powerful channel. And that's pretty much what has been happening since the beginning. Now, as we have more financial means and stuff like that, we can start, you know, doing more work. You know, we can start, you know, putting money on paid advertising and different channels and stuff like this. But fundamentally, our growth engine remains the community today.
What were some initial actions that you guys took to glue this community?
We started a discourse forum, like practically. It's a very continuous effort. So you have to force the community at first, you know? So the reason I started the community was because people were emailing me for questions and bugs and stuff like this. So bugs getting to my inbox was fine because while I was fixing them, but questions around, you know, how do you suggest I build this? At some point, I just had too many of them and it felt a little bit, you know, stupid to answer privately to people while, you know, this content could be useful for everyone. And so I created this discourse forum and the way it worked was like someone would email me because I was still the first thing. People would not go in the forum at first. Why? You know, it was very dead, right? And I had a saved response in my mailbox, in my Gmail saying, I would love to respond to your response, but do you mind copy-pasting that on the forum so that other people can read the response? And it didn't always work. Like some people were like, this is unacceptable and they would leave the platform. And that probably was for the best at that point because, you know, you have to have the right users at the right time. But most people knew that I was founder and that I didn't have anyone else to do that. And they were pretty understanding. And so the action is, it's not really an action, it's a very strong commitment to being extremely diligent when people post something on the forum. Because imagine you emailing someone and he tells you, I will respond to you if you copy paste that on the forum, and then it takes a day to respond. Then you're going to be like, hey, come on, like you respond me quickly to copy paste and then you let me, you know, wait. So you basically have to be pretty much continuously on the forum and answer immediately so that people feel like, because next time you're going to ask them to do the same thing, that they will get a response quickly, right? Mm-hmm. And so you do that for like 3 months. And 3 months in, at some point, you know, well, first of all, people started reading the content because some questions that they had already been answered. And this course is pretty good with search, actually. Mm-hmm. And then other people started answering each other. Mm-hmm. And then it's basically done, you know, like you still obviously need to keep maintaining. And today, you know, the team keeps an eye on what's going on the platform, mm-hmm. on the forum. But effectively, things tend to run on their own. And now we have a community. Some of our users are moderating the community. So it's a pretty self-sustained group of people helping each other.
I love that customer support piece. So at that point, was it just you and your co-founder together? One person build the product, the other person just answer all the questions?
I mean, and building the product. Josh would build more the infrastructure and I would build the product more. So that's how we were splitting. And doing the emails. And it was a pretty fair split.
I mean, when I'm, as an outsider, when I'm like looking at your company or looking at you and your co-founder's background, you guys seems like the typical YC founders. Like, why didn't you guys like raise money earlier?
The true reason is that we felt like we kind of knew better and we didn't want people to tell us what to do, which in some respect was a good idea for some stuff. And in some respect was not a good idea. I think some mentoring earlier would have been a good thing for the company. What I would say though is another thing that we saw is that the product would take quite some time before being able to generate enough revenue to read a subsequent round. And so fundraising mm-hmm. always felt very risky to us. You know, mm-hmm. the thing with fundraising is that once you raise a round within 18 months to 2 years, usually, except if you raised insane amounts, you're going to have to go for another round and show, you know, something to investors. And mm-hmm. we felt that what we had at Bubble, what we were working on would take quite a long time. And looking back, I think it was the right thing to do. You know, some companies raised seed rounds, went mm-hmm. to YC, like exactly what you're describing, at the same time as we did, or maybe a year later, and they went out of business pretty quickly because it takes time to get a product that can generate revenue. And today, when you look at the tools, like what I call a tool, something like Bubble, you know, something like, you know, Notion, Webflow, these kind of tools that can let you do a lot of things because they're pretty open-ended, mm-hmm. all of them had a pretty non-traditional fundraising story, if you look at it, actually.
So when it comes to competitors, assuming now, like it's, I feel like you guys are pretty big and pretty significant. When you first started, I assume there were a lot of people who were doing something similar or like along the same line. How do you view these?
Because in 2012, you have to put that in the context of, you know, it was all, you know, Code Academy was really hot. It was all about mm-hmm. teaching kids how to code. It was, you know, the beginning of technology as a consumer tech, if you will, you know, with Facebook mm-hmm. going public, Airbnb started taking off and everything. And people were like, wow, that's so cool what you can do with code. And so we mm-hmm. were kind of the party crashers a little bit because we were like, no, we're ruining the party. You know, we're like, no, actually, you know what? Learning how to code is not going to work. Let's build something else because it's faster and cheaper to use it. And people mm-hmm. did not buy that at all. Things have changed, but it took some time.
When you were not raising, how were you sustaining yourself at the beginning before you guys made the first amount of money?
Personal savings.
How long did that last until you got like a paid client?
I mean, we got a paying client extremely early on. It was in December 2012. It was a $50 check and it was every month. But you don't live on $50, right? So we got paying customers very early. But it's important actually, you know, to have a business that can find even one person willing to pay you $50 every month. It's not nothing, and it really validates not that the market is big, but that there is a market, and that's important. I think we were still living on our personal savings for probably a couple of years before we started taking like a small salary. I think it exemplifies the fact that Josh and I are extremely committed here because, you know, we put our time, our money, everything we had basically in this.
Yeah, for sure. At what point did you feel like this is going to turn into something super significant? Since like, I feel like as a founder myself, like even I believe I'm going to be extremely successful one day, I will become Oprah, but like my family or friends are always like, so did you get your advertiser? Like, you know, even when you got your advertiser, you were like, oh, are we going to get the next one? Right. It's similar to how you guys found your clients, right? At what point did you find this thing is going to be significant? Like there's a lot of people that just gonna throw money at us.
You know, maybe call that, you know, reality distortion. But since the very beginning, we've always thought that if we can put it off, if we can build the right product, how can this not be one of the biggest companies in the world? Because programming is hard. And no one has ever said programming was easy, by the way. In 2012, it was, we're going to teach people to build computer software with code, but no one says we're going to learn that in 5 minutes. You know, that's why that's why Code Academy was such a big business back then, because people were spending quite some time on it, right? So our take was like, look, this is a very hard problem to solve. A lot of people say it's actually impossible to solve, but we think we have a way to do it. Programming is expensive, tedious, and not many people can do it. If you can let people do not everything that you can do with code, but it's the 90% of what you can do with code, without code, by non-engineers, faster and cheaper. I mean, you would need to be very a bad business person to not make that a huge thing. You know, like the value proposition is insane here, right? So the question is, can you succeed at building that product? And that's where, you know, it takes a very long time and perseverance, because you can't really look at it and say, okay, it's not going to work. I mean, you can, but that basically means, okay, I guess we're not the right team to solve that problem through software. And Josh and I felt like we were the right team to solve that. And today, I think with, you know, 60 people, I think we have the right team to do that. It takes a different kind of engineering and it's a little bit complicated, but there are ways to do that. We've proven that we can go pretty far here. And so now every day it feels more obvious to me that the opportunity is massive. But this is a kind of company and product that kind of creates its own opportunity, you know, because you need the product to be good enough to realize it. But theoretically, since the beginning, it felt like, you know, yes, of course, there's something massive here.
Okay, so I'm not a coder. So please, like, enlighten me on, like, what is the theory or, like, what is the structure behind it? So is that, like, for example, let's say I want to build a Tinder for dog or something. And then I just go onto GitHub or something, and then I will, like, download that amount of code and then paste it into somewhere, and then this will just be like a template that I use to build Tinder for dog. Is that how it works with Bubble? So I'm just, like, trying to explain it to my non-technical listeners.
It starts, so you could very much build something like Tinder for dog on Bubble with dogs, that the kind of things that we've seen people build. It starts by learning the platform at some point. This is something that I keep repeating, and so thank you for giving me an opportunity to repeat that again. There is a learning curve. And at the end of the day, if there is no learning curve, that means you can't build real things. If you want to be able to build something exactly what you want, something as advanced as, you know, something like Airbnb or Twitter, places like this, that means the platform needs to be open-ended. That means you're going to probably make some mistakes and not make the best decision at first. And you're going to have to learn how to fix your mistakes or to figure out what the right design approach is. And so you're going to have to learn the tool. So we see people learning it. You have multiple ways to learn it. Some people learn it in a few hours on their own. It's definitely possible. I wouldn't say most people. I think most people take a little bit longer, like maybe 10, 15 hours. We've seen people take a lot of classes, actually. We also distribute our own classes. And so after maybe 10, 15 hours of learning, then you start building your product. And that's kind of one of the things we have to teach. And one of the things we spend some time on with our boot camps is, it's not just about learning how to use Bubble. It's about learning how to build a product. And that's not necessarily something that people have thought about very carefully when they think, okay, I want to build like a Tinder for dog. You know? And so it starts usually with doing things on paper, actually. That's usually what I recommend. I think that usually is the best way to put things. So you start drawing on the paper, you know, the different pages and everything. And then you start building it by saying, you know, okay, this is this button. When the user clicks on this button, this is what I want to happen. Mm-hmm. So create something in the database, change the page, charge a credit card, sign your user up. We've pre-built all these things for you. And then you start building, you launch it, you test it, share it with your friends, and you keep iterating. So it's not going to be very different from what you would do as a software engineer. It's just that the medium you're using is going to be your mouse. And not your hands on a keyboard to type some code. We do have some templates that people can use to start. So we do have actually quite a few templates around Tinder because it's a popular app out there, which we've seen people use as well. So it's really up to you how you want to start.
I guess, like, just trying to understand it from building Bubble in, like, a nutshell. So curious, like, how can you power people doing, like, so many different projects, like, on a back end?
Yeah, it's the core of the company. You know, like, it's how do you create a system that can support a lot of different workflows and designs from our users? That's kind of what we've been doing for 9 years, you know, and there's no, like, general rule here. I would argue, like, a lot of companies look as the same, actually. Like, if you start uploading pictures of people on Airbnb, It's basically a geolocation-based dating website, right? You can see pictures of people, you can reach out, they can message back, and, you know. So all these applications at the end of the day are a database, right? But it's true that, you know, people tend to combine those different things differently. And so you need to create a system that can consume very different types of design. And that's what, yeah, that's what the team has been busy to do since 9 years. You know, we need particularly good engineers because it requires, there is a lot of like abstractions with what we do, because we need to build something that works for any application that we don't know. We don't know how applications will look like. We don't know what they'll do, and it still has to work.
We're talking about like recruiting, right? Like recruiting the best engineers, like for people to work at Bubble, like what kind of projects do they have to build, or like what kind of, like how do you kind of like recruit the top engineers?
I mean, we have a pretty rigorous recruiting process in terms of where they're from. We have seen everything. We've seen people come from like large tech companies like Google and Microsoft, as you mentioned. We've seen people straight out of college doing extremely well, by the way. I think engineering is one of the interesting fields where you can actually have a ton of experience at 21 if you started coding pretty young and have a lot of code behind you and being able to do a lot of things. We have quite a few former founders at Bubble as well. I'm not exactly sure it was on purpose. It just happened that, you know, we found the qualities that we liked with them. I mean, usually the ability to take things from zero to one that founders tend to have. And all kind of, I mean, but then we have also, you know, one of our most senior engineers was in the military for a few years and then were teaching mathematics, you know, and then, you know, now it's one of our engineers. So we've seen people with very different profiles. I would say it's really about the skill set at that point. And that's something that's why we interview a lot of people, because resumes don't always show you like hardcore engineering skills. Interviews do.
In terms of like making your company successful now, I guess two parts of the question. One part is like to scale Bubble, how do you identify what's like the next thing for you guys? Like, is that going to be like creating more product for different group of people, or is that going to be like marketing expansion?
A little bit everything, honestly. You know, it's going to be definitely a lot of work on the product, not necessarily feature expansion, because I think we have a lot of features today. It's more about, you know, making sure the product is easier to learn, scales well, is high performing, good performance regardless of the size of the application. So a lot of work like that, trying to really make it work for any type of user. I'm not sure if I want to say that marketing, but more, again, evangelization and education, like educate more people to know how to use Bubble. At the end of the day, we'll only succeed at scale if we have a ton of people who know how to use our product. And so we need to train them how to use it. And it doesn't necessarily mean train them in classes, even though we did that, we do that. But it can be, you know, through better content, better copy on the website, being active, you know, in the right conferences or the right schools, or having the right partnerships with the right student organizations, so that people can be exposed to Bubble and be exposed to Bubble at a time where they want to learn. Or they have time to learn. Because again, if you don't have time to learn, it is a little bit challenging.
I think you mentioned evangelization a lot more than like, you know, marketing or like basically any type of like other PR related things. What's the differences? And then how do you make sure that people evangelize this thing? Because I feel like in those surveys, typically the last question would be, well, you recommend Microsoft Word to your friends. I'm like, I'm not going to say that in any conversation that I will have to my friends.
So that's exactly what the evangelization is about, is to be part of the conversation, even if people don't have anything to build. Because knowing about Bubble unlocks the market. Like most people don't even think, you know, when they're at work or they need to build a product, oh, I wish I could be an engineer and build that. Or I wish I could find an engineer to help me build that. You know, non-technical founders do, because they've already thought a lot about their ideas. But a lot of professionals in the office, you know, they're not really thinking in those terms because they just think it's impossible. So that's why evangelization means, you know, or like awareness, really making sure that people are aware that turns out that if one day they need to build something, it is possible with something like Bubble, because then suddenly at work, they start identifying opportunities to improve what they're doing with software. And so that's why we don't talk too much about pure marketing, because marketing tends to know. I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, marketing would be a fine word to describe what we do, but evangelization or awareness building is a way to explain to people that there is a movement happening right now, which is, you know, called no code, and Bubble in particular, that lets people build things without writing code. And if one day you need a product, turns out you can do it. Like that's an opportunity for you. But it's very important to frame it that way and not necessarily, you know, go to engineers and tell them use Bubble and don't write code, because I don't think, I mean, we have a few engineers using us, but it's not necessarily going to be the most exciting segment for us because they can already have other options, right? And so that's what we mean by evangelization.
When you are identifying your core user or like the user that you want to expand yourself to, how do you analyze the market? Who do you think is the people that you want to tap into?
I guess we did a very bad job on that one because we did not analyze the market, actually. We started thinking, okay, we have a group of people here. They're smart and driven, and they want to build a product, and they're not technical, and they can't because it's impossible to find an engineer. And it's just wrong that these people can't start something because some of the ideas they have may not become the next Facebook, but they're certainly worth experimenting, worth being tried out. And we felt it was wrong that people couldn't do that. You know, we felt like, you know, especially because usually outsiders tend to come with better ideas, I think, to solve problems. And by definition, people who don't know how to code, don't have their best friend who's an engineer and do not have access to capital to raise money and build a team are outsiders. And so we started more feeling like, you know, there is something wrong in the world today. Let's fix it. Now, at the same time, we felt, so if we succeed and we effectively make, as I was saying earlier, programming easy and cheaper and faster, of course, it's going to be working out, right? So that's how it started. Then the question is, was that the right customer segment to start with? I think so. I think actually, when we started in 2012, people didn't think it was. And today, you know, there is something called no-code movement and something called the maker movement, which is exactly on the segment we're going after, which is non-technical people in need of a product. The reason we felt it was a good market to be at is, again, if you go to an engineer with a product like Bubble, because the product at first is going to be having, is going to have some limitations, engineers tend to see the limitations first. And at some point, they're going to hit a limitation and they're not going to be patient because they'd be like, well, I can just build that with code. So let me go back to code. If you go to someone who's non-technical, they're going to hit limitations as well. That happens. And you tell them, sorry, can you wait a month? They will wait. And they're more willing to work with you because they don't have any other option, right? And we felt it was a better crowd to help us build the product.
You guys started with like going through these like co-founder matching events. And then, you know, like I'm currently in like a creator cohort. So like basically our teacher teaches to like create like a profile of people that are like going to be who is like our audience or something. And then like, did you guys create that profile? What does that look like for you?
It's a non-technical, but tech savvy. So someone who enjoys playing with, you know, SaaS tools. They have not, they know roughly that there is a thing called an API, but they have not necessarily written, you know, the curl command to hit that API and test it. So that's kind of like, yeah, the non-technical tech savvy person wanting to get into technology, but didn't get into engineering school as a kid, as a student. And yeah, and we've seen people, I mean, in terms of actual demographics, it's been anything, you know, I've seen people doing that while in high school. I've seen people doing that when in the 70s. I've seen a lot of, you know, former consultants and lawyers doing that. And so definitely non-technical people. I've seen some product managers doing that. On paper, it sounds like a good fit, right? Because they know about product and they're usually not the most technical people at the tech company. But we've had people that were much less technical than product managers.
You mentioned that like you wanted to scale Bubble to become like the next generation of Microsoft. What is like your vision for the next, say, 20, 30 years to get there?
Keep pushing on our current segment, which means making sure that, you know, tens, if not hundreds of millions of people know how to use Bubble. Because at some point, the Bubble skill set being spread out is the most important thing for us, even more than, you know, revenue in many ways. Because if people know how to use a product, then at some point they'll come to the platform because the need for software keeps growing and we'll be fine revenue-wise if we do that. So a lot of work on the evangelization part, and then expand what you can do with a product, especially when people start getting bigger on the platform, so have bigger applications. So either start with our current companies, one of the, you know, few thousands of companies using us today, and grow with them, or start tackling larger companies. At some point, we're going to want to move into, you know, medium-sized businesses and like larger enterprise because they have a real need for this. It's not something we've explored very strongly yet, but something there is that we can do there. Once we've done that, then we'll start expanding to other platforms, of course, and other platforms being, you know, probably native mobile, but I don't know what the next platform will be. We'll see, you know.
Yeah, for sure. Let's say like step one is to like basically getting more people to know Bubble as a product and know how to use it. In terms of like grouping your team, since you mentioned like a lot of people were like engineers, what is the DNA of your company right now? So how many people is like the evangelization part of the business? And then how many people are like actually building the product?
I think it's about half of the team. So, you know, a little bit around 30 people today building the product. So what that means is, you know, product managers, designers, and engineers. Mm-hmm. The success team that is here to assist our users, because, you know, you can't always just rely on the community to do that, is about 10, 12 people. Mm-hmm. And then the market, what we call like growth and marketing or go to market, is about 8 people, including people building our bootcamp program. They don't mm-hmm. teach the classes themselves. Like, classes are being taught by people outside of our organization, but they would do this. They would run the program. Again, the evangelization effort, I mean, it's all our users, really. That's really what we're trying to do here, is not to do all that work ourselves, because it's honestly too big of a job compared to the opportunity. But the question is, how can we work with our current users to do that with them? And so we're trying to find different enablers to really push our users to teach classes to others, you know, help them. You know, a lot of people actually start making a full-time living on the platform. They have, you know, Bubble services, whether it's training or whether it's freelancing services, trying to find different programs to help them do that better. Because I really see the community as an extension of the company here. It would mm-hmm. be pretty challenging to do that without the help.
For sure. When you think about like go-to-market, so I feel like, say, we chat about Notion, we chat about Webflow. Like, I'm not exactly sure, but I read in an article. So basically all these companies starting with like selling it to B, right? It sounds like you guys are selling to like a lot of individual people who are starting mm-hmm. companies, right? Why don't you guys start with selling it to B, since like that's where the larger amount of money at?
The reason being, we want it to be used by people that would use this for like customer facing open projects to the world, because it was kind of the harder thing. And we decided that if we work on solving the harder problem first, then you get a better product. There are a lot of tools actually that are called no-code tools in the enterprise world, where they go to companies, indeed they can make a lot of money, but then the product they're building is usually quite simpler, because mm-hmm. Large companies would not use them for like customer facing products at first, right? And so we decided, let's go for like what is a little bit harder. And then once we, and from there, expand to bees. And effectively, that's what's happening. You know, some of our users started as one individual, and then they raised, you know, $10 million, and mm-hmm. they don't become like a large enterprise, but they certainly become like a more sophisticated user from a B2B versus B2C standpoint. And we grow with them.
I definitely see that. So now, because of you guys are having a lot of success, as well as like no code became a trend. So I assume like bigger company like Amazon, or I think they would start trying to get a piece of the pie. Like, what is your core competency, and then how do you be more competitive than your competitors?
Yeah, I mean, the big players start looking at what we do, but you know, they didn't wait for Bubble to exist to look at this. I mean, what we're trying to do is a hard problem. Microsoft has tried to do that for many, many years, mm-hmm. if not decades. Well, our secret sauce is, I think, you know, focus and care. You know, like when you spend 9 years on the same thing, you develop a pretty deep understanding of what the right product looks like, which is something that is hard to replicate for other companies. I would say at this point, though, the more competitors, almost the better, because our true competition is not other no-code tools. It's really code, and convince mm-hmm. people that they should learn they should trust and learn no-code technologies to be a product. And so the more validation there is from the market, the better.
For sure. What do you think was like your founder insight in the early stage when you started the company?
I think we identified a problem that a lot of other founders didn't see, because by definition, most founders are technical. So by definition, they didn't think there was a need, because they were like, that's fine. And the fact that we're exposed to New York, some personal experiences that Josh and I had made us feel like, no, actually, there is a need there. And that's going to be a bigger and bigger need, because software demand is going to increase. So what we saw a problem that a lot of people didn't think was one until it was obvious it was one. And now we see much more founders trying to do what we're doing.
What is like one thing that you've learned through your journey running this company?
I get that things take more time than you think. Like it's a longer project than I thought it would be, but that's fine.
So we're at the last part of the interview. I have a 1 minute fire round for you. So first question, what's your favorite book?
It's going to be a French book that you probably haven't heard of that had a very big impact on my life when I read it. It's a story of someone figuring out his life journey toward the end of his life and realizing that what he wants is probably not what people think he wants is probably not what he truly wants.
Who made the biggest impact in your career?
I mean, my co-founder. Because if I hadn't met him at that coffee shop in New York, I probably wouldn't be a founder today. So.
Who would you invite to your dinner party?
I mean, friends, usually. I think dinner parties are more about friends and like friendship are more important than trying to make them professional.
Yeah, I feel you. What's your information diet look like?
I read the news. I like knowing what's going on, especially French news, because it's my way to stay connected to my home country. So that's kind of what I look at, like French newspapers. But I'm not particularly strict on my like Twitter following or anything like this.
One day after you went on to become like the next generation of Jeff Bezos, what would you do?
Probably move back to France and start to see whether I can help there.
Where can we find you outside of work?
I walk around a lot. I like walking around in New York. So if you walk around in New York, you might see me, especially with a young baby. I have a little girl. So spending quite some time with her outside when the weather is good. Otherwise, I like being close to the sea. So if I find ways to get close to the sea, I grew up on the shore. So that's something that I get a lot of my energy there.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Emmanuel, for coming onto the show today.
Thank you very much.